session number 20602, Reel 1.
One, where were you born, please?
I was born in a place called Great Hallambury, which is in Essex, near to Bishop Stortford, across the border from Hertfordshire.
Which year was this?
1921.
Did your parents come from Bishop Stortford area, both of them?
My mother came from that area, but my father came from Norfolk. He was from Swaffham, but my mother was from Bishop Stortford.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, he was a senior pest officer, in charge of, you know, pest destruction and containment in Essex and Hertfordshire.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school at Bishop Stortford.
Which school was that?
Hockerell Boys' School, which regrettably is now closed. It's no longer about.
How old were you when you finished there?
I was only 14 when I left school.
So that would have been in 35?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
Oh, yes, yes. When I first left school, I went to work as a clerk in a corn merchant's office. And the reason I got that was the man who was in charge of that, a chap called APA Church, he owned a number of businesses, and this one in particular at Bishop Stortford. Apparently he was on the board of governors of my school, and he went and saw our headmaster and said, look, he wanted somebody quickly, because someone had to leave in a hurry. He wanted someone quickly, and he wanted a bright boy who was good at mathematics and things and was able to keep a clear head and a clear mind. So the next thing I know was I was interviewed by the headmaster and said, I've talked to him about various people, including you, and he has said he wants you to be the man. Will you go? So I said, well, I don't know. That means leaving school early, doesn't it? So he said, well, yes, it does. So I said, well, I'll see what my parents say. So, of course, I asked my parents, and they said, well, no, it's all right. If you want to go, go. So I went there, and I worked for this chap, APA Church at Bishop Stortford, to begin with, for about 9 months, I think, in a corn merchant's office, doing filing, and then I learnt to type and was typing letters and things like that. The amazing thing is, to me, in those days, I was a very bad writer. Very bad. So much so, on the day when I left school, on this early leaving thing, they had a big parade of all the school people there, and the headmaster made a fine tribute to me and said what a fine scholar I'd been and how many times I'd won the first prize for being top of class of this and top of class of that and all this sort of thing. You know, and he gave me a wonderful build-up. He really did. And then he said, but of course, there's one thing he can't do. He can't write. He's horrible at writing. Then he called his little boy, I think he's about 11, this boy was, from another form, called him in, and he said, write up on the blackboard, William, we all wish Bob Palmer the very best of luck. And this bloody boy, this big, stood out there with a piece of chalk, and he wrote that up on the blackboard, and it was just like copper plate. Beautiful. Really was just like copper plate writing. And that hurt me a bit, because I thought, well, that's sort of, you know, he compliments me a lot on the one hand, says how bright I am and how clever, and then he goes and does that. But anyway, that didn't matter really in the long term. It worked out all right, because while I was at churches working for them, I'd been there about 3 days, and my immediate boss gave me a letter. And he said, yeah, the boss wants you to copy this on the typewriter, will you? Well, I got this thing. And I turned it upside down, inside out, and I couldn't read it. I just could not read it. I said, I'm ever so sorry. I said, but I can't possibly do that. I can't read it. Whose writing is it? He said, oh, that's the boss's. I said, what? Because when I went in and saw him, when he welcomed me that on the day before, he said, I've got a wonderful report from you. He said, except they tell me you can't write. But apart from that, he said, you've got a wonderful reference. Very sort of sharp like that. Well, somewhere in the archives there, I've actually got the reference that he finally gave me when I left some months later. He wrote this, would you believe, in longhand, but using a copy type pencil, you know. What do you call them? Indelible pencil. Fancy writing anything like that. But the writing on that is atrocious. And yet he had cheek enough to say that to me. So anyway, what happened, in a cut a long story short, what happened was, I said to my immediate boss, I said, I don't like this writing business. One day a letter came in from Ireland, of all places, and it was lovely looking writing, really lovely looking stuff. So I took it into my immediate boss and I said, oh, I like the look of that. I wonder if I could ever learn to write like that. Of course you can, he said. I'll help you. And he sent away and got some special books of handwriting features and things. And we started this writing business. And I got to the stage when I could write very, very, very nicely. So much so, in fact, that in later years, when I worked at the Bishop Stortford College in the bursary, I used to get the job of writing in the front of their books. The first prize has been awarded to Bruce Voller, or whatever his name is, for this, that and the other, you know, because I could do that. And then they taught me what they call order script writing. That's where you have a pen of different widths, so you can have a wide width coming down that way and a thin line going the other. It looks very nice, looks very smart when you do order script writing. But that's how it changed from being a horrible writer to being really what you might say was a very good writer eventually. And it all came about as a result of that start.
Did you join TA before the war?
Yes, what happened was a lot of my friends had joined the Territorial Army. Now, my father had been in the First World War and had a bad time. He was in the Grenadier Guards. And he was shot up 4 times. Now, each time must have been pretty bad because on each occasion they sent him home, you know, to England for repair. But after hospitalisation, that he went back, and no sooner did he get back than he caught another one. He had 4 lots of serious injuries. Anyway, I said to Dad, look, I said, Dad, all my friends are joining up the terrorists. I think I'd like to do that. So he said, now you hold on a minute, son. You realise what there's going to be a war before long, don't you? This was in, what, 1938. He said, there's going to be a war. Definitely there's going to be a war before long. He said, this state isn't going to last like this. He said, and if you're in the Territorial Army, that means you'll be the first ones in, thrown in at the deep end. So I said, well, that might be right, Dad, but put it this way. If I've got to go to war, if it does happen, I'd rather go with a lot of my friends and people that I know rather than be thrown in with people from Liverpool, Manchester, Scotland and somewhere where I don't know them at all. So after arguing a little bit, he eventually relented and said, all right, well, join then. So I did, and I'm glad I did. That's how I came to be in the Terriers.
What unit did you join?
I joined the 147th Essex Yeomanry Field Regiment Royal Artillery at a place called Harlow in Essex. We started off in the drill hall. And I was eventually called up, of course, just a few days before the war. And we started off at that drill hall at Harlow.
What equipment did the unit have pre-war?
18-pounder, which were First World War guns, and 4.5 howitzers. That's what we started off with, did our training on. 18-pounders and 4.5 howitzers. Both of them First World War things, you know. But then, after a period of time, we went all through different changes. We were sent out quite quickly on coastal defence work all over various parts of the country. We started off at Walton, near Felixstowe, and then we went down to Holt in Norfolk. And then we did a period in London on what they call vulnerable point duty. We were at King's Cross Railway Station and things like that. And we changed eventually to 25-pounders field guns, which were beautiful guns. And after a period of time, they changed that and they made us self-propelled with American Sherman-type tanks with the turret taken off and a 75mm gun put on. None of us liked those. They were horrible things. But after a few months training on that, they then changed us to something quite similar, but it pleased us immensely. They gave us 25-pounder self-propelled guns with the British 25-pounder on it instead of this horrible 75mm American thing. And that's what we finally went to war with, exactly like that. And they were wonderful guns, wonderful. The big difference, of course, with those to a tank is if a tank is travelling any way it likes, it can be going in any direction, and whilst it's travelling, if it want to, they can fire in any direction because it's got a 360-degree circuit on the top. With a self-propelled gun, that's not there. They've taken the turret away and they put this big gun in its place. So all you've got, in our case, we had 47 degrees of top traverse. So you could move 47 degrees, no trouble. If you want to move more than that, you've got to move your vehicle first. Do you understand me? Otherwise, you know, you can fire anywhere, you can fire over there or over there, but first you've got to move the vehicle. And then you can finish up aligning exactly what you want on the finer points on the ordinary machinery of the gun by spinning the wheels.
Why didn't you like those American SP guns?
Well, there were two reasons. One, it was American and not British, which, you know, I suppose we were a bit biased against. The other one was, seems a dreadful thing, but we were always told, if you drop a 75-pounder shell on its nose, it will explode. If you drop a 25-pounder on its nose, it will not explode. The reason for that is the 25-pounder had an inbuilt safety mechanism. You know, when it comes out of the barrel, it doesn't come out straight like that. It twists, rotates because of the rifling in the gun. And once the rifling takes effect and the 25-pounder shell starts to spin round, that undoes the safety catch. So until that safety catch is undone, even if you did drop it on its nose, it wouldn't explode. But the 75mm ones would. 75-pounder ones would. So we didn't like them. But when we got those, oh, we were thrilled to bits because we always loved the 25-pounder field gun. And now to get the 25 field gun mounted on a Sherman tank chassis, absolutely ideal. And we were all thrilled to bits. I don't know anybody in the unit who wasn't pleased about that. Suited us ever so well. And we really looked forward eventually to going to war. The odd thing was we got messed about quite a lot. We did a lot of training in all parts of this country. Up in Scotland and Wales we went, all sorts of places, doing training for special events and landing off LCTs and things like that. But the amazing thing was I was given a week's leave to go to the Middle East. I'm not sure now, I think that was 1943, I think it was. Everything was all ready, and the day before I was due to go, I got a telegram cancelling it and saying, no, you're not going, so I didn't go to the Middle East. And eventually we were called up and we were sent down to Lord Montague's estate at Bewley in Hampshire. And that's where we were incarcerated under American guards behind barbed wire, sealed unit for, I don't know, 10 days or something like that before the D-Days took place. And then when the time came for the invasion to take part, for us to take part in the invasion, it was on the night of the 4th of June, not the 5th of June. The night of the 4th of June, we were loaded on our boat, on our LCT, and we started off because that's what we thought was going to happen. We were going. But we get about a third of the way, I suppose, across the channel or something like that, and it was terribly, terribly rough, terribly rough. Ever so many people were seasick. I was lucky I wasn't, but ever so many people were, most of them were. Anyway, we get about a third of the way across and they turned us back. They said, no, it's too rough to go on. We'll have to go back. So we went back. Well, the next night, they put us on the boat again. And this time they said, right, you're going. And we went. And this time we went all the way across. But in my honest opinion, it was rougher then than it had been the night before. And, oh, so many people were so ill on the boat. My friends were all, you know, sick and bad and ill and didn't care what they faced as long as they get off that blooming boat. One of my friends I remember in particular, he said, I don't care what we face, Bob, as long as we get off this bloody boat. And he kept being sick and sick and sick. It's horrible. Well, again, I was lucky. I wasn't ever seasick, ever. So I was one of the lucky ones. But almost everyone on board aircraft was seasick, including most of the sailors that were on it. But what happened was we started off nicely, and this time we got something like, I suppose it was halfway across. In the middle of the night, pitch dark, and suddenly there was an emergency call. Everybody man the decks, everybody man the decks. The engine's broken down, we're loose in a minefield. And there we were in a bloody minefield. Well, there was some moon, so you could see a bit, but you couldn't see terribly well. So we all lined the whole of the boat all the way around, was looking for mines. If anyone spotted one, you had to call a sailor, and the sailor boys had to come and push it away, you know, with a stick so it didn't touch the boat, because they got all these little horns sticking out, and you know, if you hit the side, the thing would explode. And that carried on like that, but because we were in this minefield broken down, it made us late. So I did not go in at the time I should have done with the rest. We were about something like an hour delayed. And in an effort to catch up, our skipper put on sort of full steam ahead sort of thing to try to get us there. And ultimately, we got to the right place at the right time. But where we missed out was this. We were on a flat-bottom boat, an LCT, landing craft tank, and the idea was, with these guns, you fire from the boat. As you approach the shore, so you fire at the shore. That was the whole idea of them. Well, of course, in our case, we were too far behind ours, so we couldn't do it. So we didn't fire onto the land from the boat. But when we eventually got to our landing point, we caught up with the others at the time they were going to land, so we all went in together at the right time. So I landed at the right place at the right time. The only thing we didn't do, we didn't take part in what was called the run-in shoot. But it's one of those things, I suppose. We were the only troop to miss out on it. All the other troops took part in it, but we didn't.
What exactly was the run-in shoot?
All that means is that as you're approaching the shore, you fire from the boat, with your guns from the boat, over the heads of the infantry and people who were there, and the others, so that as your craft gets nearer in, so you're firing onto the land ahead of you. But as I say, our particular craft wasn't able to do that because we were delayed in this hold-up in the minefield. And a thing I remember ever so well, quite frightening really, I can't remember the name of the boat, it was a cruiser. I've got an idea it was Rodney, but I'm not honestly sure about the name. But at one stage when we caught up with all the others, we were a little bit too far to the right, so our skipper turned us round to our left to pick up our proper position to go in. And as we did, we went underneath the guns, so to speak, of this big cruiser. And as we were underneath the guns going across, so he fired a broadside. Oh, most frightening thing I think has ever happened to me. We all sort of leapt up in the air. Terrible, terrible noise. We felt as if we'd been lifted out of the boat. But anyway, we got by safely. We passed by and we didn't get hurt at all or anything like that. And then we found our proper position and we went into land. Now, when we went into land, a strange thing happened. I was due to be number two off our boat in my self-propelled gun. The first one off was due to be a half-track vehicle. You know what I mean by a half-track vehicle? You know, wheels at the front and track at the back. That was the command post for our battery. And the man in charge of that was the battery sergeant major, a man called Herbert Broom from Colchester. So when the time came, you've got two men standing, one each side of the ramp, sailors, with their marker poles, sounding for depth like this. And in due course of time, they turn round and go thumbs up like this to the skipper, so that he knows you're in safe area to land because of the depth. Because we're all waterproofed up to different levels, you see. I was waterproofed, I think, to 6'2", I think mine was. But anyway, they gave the thumbs up sign, so the sergeant major and his crew, five others on board, went down the ramp, they dropped the ramp, and down they went. And then it happened. Instead of going down the ramp like that and going to levelling out, they just went down the ramp and disappeared into the sea. And of course, it was dreadful. All of us run to the front, and you could see these poor devils in there struggling in the water. So we pulled them back on board, and Sergeant Major, Mr. Broom, he said, "Bob, you're the next one off." He said, "What I'll do, I'll come with you." So he climbed aboard my self-propelled gun, and he actually landed with me when we landed and acted as one of my gunners on board the gun. We didn't know at the time what caused him to go down and get lost like that. But later that day, we found out the reason. What had happened was the men were right with their poles. The depth was correct. But in between the two poles, there was a bomb crater. And, of course, Herbert and his gun had all gone straight down into this bomb crater. And as a result, that's why they were drowned. So we were the next one off. And so what they did, instead of dropping us off right where they were like that, they pulled us back a few yards, moved us a little bit to the left, and then took us in again. And this time they said, right down with the ramp, and in we go. And we went in and we landed in, I don't know, probably 5 foot of water or something like that. But we were all right. We were waterproof to over 6 foot. So we were able to get off quite nicely onto the beach with no trouble. So that we were all right there. And
which beach did you land on?
I landed on what is called Jig Green, which was part of Gold Beach. Jig Green, at a place called Lehamil, which is by the village of Arnel Samur. It looks like Asnelli Samur when you see it on the map. Asnelli Samur, Arnel Samur it's called. And that's at the village of Lehamil. And that photograph I showed you there, that's where that blockhouse is. And that's on the beach. And funnily enough, what, 4 or 5 years ago now, when they had the 50 Years After program, I don't know who it was, but somebody put my name forward to the local television unit at Norfolk, the Anglia Television. And I received a telephone call one day from a guy. He said, if I come and see you, will that be all right if I'm there tomorrow and bring the television crew? So I said, I don't know what you're talking about, what for? So he said, well, he said, you were on D-Day, weren't you? So I said, yes. He said, and I believe you got a good record on D-Day. I said, well, I was one of the privileged ones. I got on early and certainly got off all right without being, you know, killed or wounded. So I was one of the lucky ones, yes. So they sent the man over here to interview me. He came in this room, set his camera up over there and interviewed me. And during the course of it all, I told him about that blockhouse, and showed him the photograph. And as a result, what he did the next week, he and a team went over there to Lehamil, and they started off their film with that, close-up of it and everything, all of it. So when they eventually produced their bit on television with my talk and all the rest of it, it started off with that, you know, showing the actual pictures.
But if you can go back, because you had just got up to your self-propelled gun landing on Jig Green, what rank did you have at the time?
I was a sergeant then, in charge of a 25-pounder self-propelled gun. A full sergeant I was then.
Can you take me through what happened next, step by step, in as much detail as you can recollect, please?
Yeah. As I said, we were effectively the second vehicle off our craft. We got other craft to our left belonging to our air unit, and craft to our right belonging to other units which weren't anything to do with us. As we tried to land, we had a bit of difficulty getting up the beach because it was very stony, and with a track vehicle, tracks very easily slip in that sort of stuff. What was supposed to have happened, we were supposed to have had some matting put down, but something went wrong and the matting wasn't put down. So as a result, we had difficulty to begin with getting off the beach because the tracks were skidding in this cobble shingle sort of stuff, you see. But as we went to get off, we were being fired at quite heavily by machine guns from the Germans who were in position on the shore. And we were being bombarded by heavier guns further inland. German, which I don't know for sure, but I presume were their famous 88mm ones. Lots of crashes and bangs going on all around us, but luckily none of us were hit with any of those. Several of them were hit by the machine guns, and some of our poor chaps on board aircraft never landed. They had to go off aircraft, straight back onto another one, and be sent straight home to England because, you know, they were wounded. But we were on aircraft, we were lucky, we all got by quite nicely and landed all right. But as soon as we'd landed, there was a big hold up, people couldn't seem to get off the beach. And what we now know was this, there's an old track that we've got to travel along, turning right, they told us. When we get on the track, turn right, head towards Bayeux. Well, this track was an unmade road, very, very rough and ready. And each side, there were notices up, Achtung Mine, you know, the mines were laid, so we weren't allowed to go off there. But what should have happened, we should have had two, what do they call them, flail tanks were attached to us. They should have come, and one should have gone each side of that track with their flails to destroy the mines, to clear a way in. But unfortunately, both of the tanks that were allocated to us, the flail tanks, were drowned on their way in. So, of course, we didn't have that sort of support. Then they called for, what do they call them, engineers from the, what's the word I want, engineers unit, sappers, don't they call them?
Yes.
Yeah, sappers. They called for them to see if they could clear the way through, but they weren't able to for whatever reason. So it was just left, there's this thing, about as wide as this room, I suppose, the track would be, something like that. And what happened was six tanks, including one of our own, from my own regiment, but six tanks went along there. And as they went along, they passed a line of trees on their right-hand side, which as they travelled along, it meant the trees would be between them and the sea. Each time a tank passed that line of trees, boom, they were put out of action by that gun, that German 88mm, which was mounted in a very, very strong, highly fortified construction of concrete. And after it had put out these six, suddenly one of our officers, he wasn't from my own troop, but from another troop, came up to me and sort of yelled at me, "Sergeant, quick, you see what's happening? You've got the best gun there is nearest to that. Put that out of action." And he screamed at me, you know, like really, really loud and almost insulting, horribly shouting at me, "Put that out of action. It is imperative. Do you understand? Imperative." Well, of course, I could understand what he meant, but it's all very well to say that, but it's quite another thing to perhaps do it. So what I did, I climbed over the side of my self-propelled gun, got down onto the road on this unmade road, walked along the road till I got level where this line of trees were, and then I looked across, and with my field glasses, I could see ever so easily what it was. There's this enormous monster of a place, and it looked like a big, big mushroom. It was that sort of shape. And as far as I could see, the only bit that was likely to be of any help to us, if we could get there, was their gun aperture point, like that, where their gun barrel came out. The rest of it, if you hit it, you'd only be bruised in the concrete. So we've got to try and get one in that aperture. So I said to my crew, which I say included our Sergeant Major, "It's no good us going up there like all the others have done. We shall simply be number seven, won't we? If we go up nice and steadily, like they normally do when you're in a tank, you look on each side like this." So I said, "We've got to do something different and take them by surprise." So I said to the driver, "When I say go, go. Put your foot down and go." Now those things, they weighed something like 35 tonnes, but they would do about 35 miles an hour. And I said, "When I tell you to stop," that's the signal, you tap him on the head, that's the signal to stop. I said, "When I signal you to stop, I want you to immediately turn 45 degrees to your offside." That's because, as I tell you, this top traverse. I knew I couldn't turn the gun and face that way on the top traverse. So what happened was, I hit him in the back, which is the signal to go, and off he went. He flew across as fast as we could, probably, I don't know, 35 miles an hour, I would think, something like that. And we went past, and as we went past, we got away with it. We caught them by surprise, and they weren't able to pick up with us quickly like that. But quite quickly, I said to my driver, "I'll hit you on the head when you've got to stop." We did about 80 yards, I think, past the trees. I tapped him on the head. He stopped and immediately turned 45 degrees to his right. And the layer, the gun layer then, who was going to fire the gun, he could see quite clearly what the target was. So I instructed him to travel, which you shouldn't do normally, with the gun already loaded and the safety catch off to save us seconds of time. So that's what we did. We travelled with the gun loaded and the safety catch off, and as soon as the driver stopped it and steered it 45 degrees to his offside, the gun layer then with his wheels was able to manoeuvre it and steer onto the thing accurately and fire. And he, as soon as we'd almost stopped bouncing, as the tank does bounce like this is when you stop suddenly, he fired almost immediately. And the first shot actually hit, and you can in fact see on that picture there exactly where the first one hit. From where I was, I could see we'd hit the target, but it hadn't gone in the narrow bit that we wanted. It was a fraction high and a fraction to the left. So I ordered him to do deflect one to the right, drop 25 yards and fire again. So he deflected one to the right, dropped 25 yards in range, fired again. And would you believe the next one was kind enough to go right in the actual aperture? Now, if we'd have practiced it all the morning, we couldn't have got it better than that. It was marvellous. That went in and, of course, exploded inside and put the gun out of action. About four people struggled out, poor devils. I felt sorry for them, out of the back of this big emplacement with their hands over their ears, and they were waddling about like this. Obviously, they were badly knocked about. But anyway, about four of them got out, and the people who were with us, the infantry with the Hampshires, they took these people prisoner, these four people prisoner. And so that was sort of quite a successful start. And then it happened. None of us had seen it, the Sergeant Major or any or my crew or myself, none of us had seen it. But just over there on the right-hand side of us, off this unmade road, there was a German anti-tank gun. And it was highly scrimmaged up. It was in the lot of